Today is Wednesday. It's November 17th, 2021. Holy cow, it's my son's birthday. I'm John Williams, and this is the Mincing Rascals podcast. Thanks for finding us here. Share us with your friends and listen to me weekdays on WGN from 9 to noon.
I'm Austin Burke from the Illinois Policy Institute.
Brandon Pope from WCIU.
I'm John Hansen from Block Club Chicago. And when I have a son, it won't take me till the time I record a podcast to know when his birthday is.
I'm Eric Zorn, the patiently waiting publisher of the Picayune Sentinel weekly newsletter on Substack.
Patiently waiting for us to get to you in the introduction so you can derail us before we start.
But I'm also patiently waiting right now as we record for a verdict from the Rittenhouse jury up in Kenosha. And I keep refreshing my Twitter feed because I know that as soon as they announce the jury's come back, we're all going to be watching the live feed up there to see what happens.
I don't think that's going to happen today, do you?
I don't know the latest, and this is, I mean, it's weird to talk about this now because no one's listening to it now, so things will certainly have changed, but the jury wants to see some of the videos.
Yeah.
And then the lawyers are arguing about the drone video, which if you've been following this case closely, know that this was sort of a last-minute discovery on the part of the prosecutors, that there's a drone video of the incident that they say shows Rittenhouse, the teenager accused of shooting three people, killing two up in Kenosha last summer, of raising his gun and provoking the first attack on him, which could very well be a game changer as far as the – well, it was a game changer as far as the prosecution was concerned, and it could be for the jury. So you have a situation where this video people are talking about, but apparently the jury is not interested in seeing that, last I heard. They want to see other videos.
Yeah.
So I don't know what's going on up there. I thought that they might come back quickly yesterday, but they didn't. Told me that the jury is certainly split on some issues. The fact that they didn't – sometimes juries will come back and they will issue a verdict – like first thing in the morning, they just want to sleep on it. They kind of agreed. They said, well, let's sleep on it, come back in the morning. That didn't happen today as we record. It's getting close to 2 o'clock in the afternoon. So they seem to be divided on some key issues, and they're wrestling with them. And I think, John, didn't you predict a hung jury in this case?
I did. Typically, they say that when the jury's out for a long time, that favors the defendant, that favors the defense. In this case, I sort of think the opposite, that with five counts still in play, all of them felonies, and multiple ways to charge him in each of those cases, I think that what they're doing is looking for something to stick on the kid so that he doesn't completely skate. This case was looking so good for the defense, I thought they'll be out in 20 minutes. The longer they take, the more it makes me think that they're going to find something to hang on Kyle Rittenhouse. John Hansen, do you agree with me on that?
Yeah, that's the vibe I got. I appreciate that they're taking the time to do it. It's a lot to get through. I've never sat on a jury, but for a trial like this, I certainly appreciate, you know, take an extra day if you just talk through it. Maybe they are trying to find that middle ground. I felt the same way you did, John, until the defense's final closing arguments, which I thought were a little over the place and a little strange. So I imagine just being in that room, right? I mean, they know the national implications of this, and maybe they're wrestling it like we have. I mean, I'm sure they are, where, hey, this kid is a punk, but does that mean he goes to jail for the rest of his life for what he did? Let's find something that we can do here to find some sort of justice. And hopefully they come to a conclusion, but a couple extra days to be able to get there is well worth it.
I think that they are looking for something, some middle ground, because I'm guessing that if they're anything like the nation right now, there are people who are way on one side of this and there are people who are way on the other side of it. And they're saying, well, we don't want to have wasted, what was it, 3 weeks of our lives or something on this case. We want to come to some sort of decision. Let's see what we can come up with. Juries will do that. So I think that's the smartest bet right now.
How realistic do you guys think it is that this could go to a mistrial? That stuff with the prosecution, the defense is accusing the prosecution of withholding some evidence and some video stuff. This judge has been kind of, in my opinion, a little biasy. I'm wondering if a mistrial could happen still.
I just don't see him doing it. I know there's been some motions for it, which often defense teams do as a precursor to a potential appeal process. I think that's where what they're doing is logging their complaints in there so it's in the record.
See, I don't see an appeal. I don't see them. The judge has been has bent over backwards, I think, to be fair to Rittenhouse, to be fair to the defense, which, you know, you want judges because the, you know, the stakes are high and the burden of proof is on the state. And most of what the judges rules seem fine to me. He's very much an oddball. He belongs in the Good Wife. If you guys ever watched The Good Wife, all those really strange judges.
He's a primetime drama, quirky judge.
Yeah. In my opinion, you're right. Yeah. You know, these objections they're raising, I do not see the judge declaring a mistrial. If he goes off the deep end and says, okay, I'm going to declare a mistrial with prejudice, meaning that they can't be retried, only that I think would really get this nation in a real uproar. So I doubt that's happening.
No, I think what has become more and more clear to me throughout this trial and I tried to more focus on the evidence that was established there than all of the media coverage surrounding this incident when it happened and in the next few weeks after that, is that the first cut at this story from most sources to me precluded the possibility of this narrative, which I think I agree with. I think this is how I would describe what happened. There is a naive, dangerous, foolish kid in the midst of indefensible mayhem who in the end shot assailants in self-defense. And I think that is a very nuanced picture of what happened. Mm-hmm. I think that is what I believe is accurate after seeing what happened in the trial. And I think that will be completely lost no matter what this verdict is. And that is what I fear.
So that's not guilty by you then, by self-defense?
That's not guilty by me. And self-defense is... You can put yourself in some pretty stupid, dangerous situations, and self-defense is still a legitimate thing.
But you think because of the extraneous things that the jury is at least somebody's going to say, no, he's guilty, and we'll get a hung jury?
I don't know. I don't know what to think. I think parsing out the timing, I don't know if that sheds a lot of light on what the jury's considering. I think we should expect this to probably go all week, this week at least. So I'm not sure what to make of that. I can't predict what the jury's going to do.
Yeah, if it makes it till Friday night and they adjourn Friday night, that really sends the jury's hung, because oftentimes juries will wait till Friday afternoon and go, we don't want to come back on Monday. We're going to find some way out of this. So that could easily happen. To throw this forward a little bit, since we don't even know when people listening to this, what they will know that we don't know now, I don't think that this result either way is going to result in any sort of massive protests or demonstrations or shows of force or anything. I don't think that this trial, I know this country is very interested in this trial.
Yeah.
I don't think they're passionate about it. There's not like huge gatherings outside the courthouse in Kenosha. I also don't think that it's a particularly significant trial. I don't think there's going to be any long-term repercussions. I don't think that armed people are going to go out to protest and start shooting people. I don't think protesters are going to say, well, I can burn everything down because no one can do anything to me now. I don't think this is all that significant, as interesting as it is.
I'm glad that the race is lined up, just so we don't have that other layer of complexity. If the judge said that it would be a hung jury, it might have been because of the introduction of that drone video footage, but it might also be because the prosecution alluded to Ryan's staying silent when the police first questioned him, and that not only is that a right you have.
John, you said hung jury. I think you mean mistrial.
Mistrial. Thank you.
Yeah.
So not only did Kyle Rittenhouse have the right to remain silent, but I guess you're not even supposed to mention that fact, right, in trial? And I just wonder how much of that was significant to the jurors. If they heard a little bit of that and then they were dismissed and the judge yelled at them, did they really go, wow, we've got something here? I mean, do you blow up this case because of that? I don't think so.
I don't think so. There are always mistakes in every trial. No trial is perfect. And when mistakes happen, the appellate courts have to rule whether they have a significant impact, a decisive impact potentially on the jury. They're not going to say, well, you said this, you slipped up, you made that. No, I think that there's no chance that there is a groundwork has been laid here for an appeal on whatever Rittenhouse is found guilty of, if anything. I just don't see it. I think those are really small little errors that it's not going to, you're not going to get 12 people going one way who would have gone the other way if it weren't for that, that small step over the line. So I don't think so.
Is anyone surprised we're not paying as much attention to the Arbery case, the Arbery trial that's also happening in Georgia, which was probably more of a, I don't know, I don't want to say graphic video, but it was just a more shocking, equally shocking, I guess you could say, case that not a lot of people are talking about. I don't know why that is.
For us, I know Kenosha's closer to us, so I think we think local first, and Arbery's in Georgia. I've seen people talking about that case, though. So I don't know. Maybe we just different timelines. I've seen a lot of talk about that black pastor's comment.
Well, that's interesting. I mean, I thought about that. So they said we don't want that many black pastors in the audience, and the judge allowed those black pastors to be there. Didn't that remind you, though, of how sometimes the police will pack a courtroom when one of their own is on trial?
I can understand the argument for that. Al Sharpton, Reverend Jesse Jackson, these are figures. Yeah, they have Reverend in front of their name, sure, but they are political figures. There's no doubt about that. So if you see Reverend Jesse Jackson and Al Sharpton sitting with the family, it sends a message that, okay, this is a civil rights issue. This is a, I can understand the argument for it. And the same thing with police being on another side. During the Van Dyke trial here in Chicago, you had Jesse Jackson there. You had, you know, police union people as well. I think it's just a natural thing to happen with these high profile, racially charged cases. But I can understand the argument for that being something that could sway people one way or another.
Well, Brandon, if I were, I guess it would depend on the juror, but you've got to ask yourself if Al Sharpton sitting there is helpful to you or not. Maybe that, maybe they look out there and go, well, Al Sharpton's on your side, next. You know, maybe
that's a good point.
Austin, but similarly, I mean, having a fleet of police officers, I mean, that could hurt you depending on who's on that jury too. So yeah, I think I kind of bias toward letting those folks into the courtroom because that will be taken to it. It's not a, I wouldn't say that's an automatic positive for whoever is bringing them in.
Yeah.
There was a case about 20 years ago in Cook County where a whole bunch of police officers in uniform, along with Superintendent Hillard, showed up at the, in a courtroom, and a juror walked in from the back and began sobbing hysterically. That you felt so pressured by that, so intimidated by it. And I wrote about it at the time. I thought, you know, like, no, don't, you don't, the trials are not, we want the jury deciding this case on the evidence, not who's sitting in the gallery. And so I am sympathetic with the idea that maybe that they should somehow make it so that people can't see who's in the gallery, or that they keep certain people out of the gallery, or make sure that they're obscure in some way. Because you want a trial to be public, but you also want the jury to be, you know, not unduly influenced by these outside influences.
John Hanson, I did our news click, you know, that non-scientific survey that we throw out there every day. It's a conversation starter. It's not a legitimate piece of research. We asked our listeners, do you think he should do some jail time? Right? Five charges, number of ways to do it. Should he do some jail time? 7 out of 10 said what?
Yes.
7 out of 10 said no.
Whoa.
So again, just you know, throw that away if you don't like it, because it's not scientific. But
what message board did someone post that on to try and drum up some results?
I did wonder who those people are, because usually, like, if it says who's going to win the election or who's going to win the game or whatever, usually our audience tends to parrot, you know, what the traditional research would show.
Just wanted to ping on one last thing that Eric had mentioned earlier about, will this land with a, I don't want to say a dud, but will it inflame a country? And I actually think that how much coverage this has gotten, how many people have watched this televised live or live stream or the coverage of it, I think even people that want to see Kyle Rittenhouse go to jail for the rest of his life can see that it hasn't been the best handled case, maybe by the prosecutors. Maybe they've learned something or two, especially after the witness who has got shot testified to raising a gun. Maybe the calmer heads are going to prevail here a little bit, which is absolutely the opposite of what I said last week, I realize. So I must be in a better mood.
You were fit to be tied last week.
I'm sorry.
Yeah. One of the advantages of a trial like this is you see the complexities and how unique the situation was and how fine-tuned the law of self-defense is, and how, you know, and so you're not going to be able to pull out like some big meaning from it. This was, I mean, it could, you could easily say it's a close call. Whether was it reasonable? This guy, the first guy, Rosenbaum, who Rittenhouse shot, he wasn't armed. He was clearly kind of out of his mind, right? I mean,
Rosenbaum, you're talking about
him. Yeah, Rosenbaum. And so the question is like, no, my instinct would be like, you have to do what you got to do to repel somebody like that. But the law is much more fine-tuned than that. So I do think that maybe all this coverage, all this attention people have paid, have educated them in ways that they weren't before. I'm still seeing on my Facebook wall lots of people who are, you know, his mom drove him up there and stuff that's just not true. And they're not paying as close attention as
or not even relevant. But I'm telling you, Eric, you and Austin are making me crazy, though, because I just think that the case was strongest against Rosenbaum. That guy said earlier in the evening, I'm going to tear your heart out. I'll kill you if I get my hands on you, something like that. Then the two of them are in the same vicinity. They're both running in the same direction. Technically, that means Rosenbaum is chasing him. He throws a sack at him. At a great distance, doesn't hit him. And then as he gets near him, Kyle turns with that AR-15 and shoots him to death. That's, I guess, self-defense, but it just seems to me like it's such an unequal measure of defense against the threat. Let's forget about whether or not Kyle was the provocateur. I think that's insane to say that if somebody's coming at you, they're going to punch you. I don't know what they're going to do. You don't know what they're going to do. You get to shoot them dead on the spot. Never mind even if you have the gun legally.
Well, I think this is maybe why this jury is going to be out a while, is that these are not lumped together as one individual case. They can analyze each victim individually and talk about these cases, which has got to contribute to why this could take a potential long time, to exactly your point, John.
That first shooting matters a lot, right? Because if that is deemed not in self-defense, those next two become very different, right? Those are people trying to take down an assailant.
An active shooter.
Rather than someone who was acting. Exactly.
Whatever the result is here, I kind of lean where John's at. I don't think we're going to see mass protests or, George Floyd level, action after this. Partially because I feel like just from what I've seen in my orbit, a lot of black people I know are not paying that much attention to this case. They know of it, but they're kind of assuming the worst. So they're just going like, you know what? I'm just going to clear my mental and just not be bothered with the details because we know what's going to happen. We got to see what happens in Kenosha, really. All eyes are going to be on Kenosha, how the people there respond and how that spills over. But I don't anticipate anything huge happening. But also, I think he's going to get charged with something. So I think that's going to be part of it, too.
John Catanzara has taken his toys and is going home. The battling and embattled FOP president has resigned from the Chicago Police Department. Under remarks, he wrote on his resignation form, finally, let's go Brandon, says he wants to run for mayor. Is he going to stay on, you guys, as the Fraternal Order of Police president? And was he going to get fired from the force anyway, Austin? Do you think that he had to quit because he was going to get kicked out?
Maybe. Also, though, I think he took a moment where there's a lot of media attention on him and said, hey, this is a opportunity to double down and make a political move. And when we were talking about this on your show this week, John, I think I made the point that the policing in Chicago, I will say again and again, has become so much more political than it has been professional. And I said that before Catanzara resigned. And what is he resigned to do? He's running for mayor, because that's all we can understand in our little Chicago pea brains is we must, someone's got to be mayor and fix everything. And the problem with that narrative is that you're just going to keep getting people like Catanzara until you get serious about fixing the management problems at CPD. I said this on your show. I think the average Portillo's chain restaurant has better management practices than the Chicago Police Department does. And until you fix that, there is going to be an ugly expression of officers who feel like the city doesn't have their back, electing people like John Catanzara and keeping them in place because they're their attack dogs who just they know have their back and they're fighting against all the right people. And what's sad is not only I would caution people who are only putting that on the Catanzara faction, not getting that stuff done. The Lightfoot administration has been out to lunch on this. There's two people who high profile people who resigned over the summer and fall that the Tribune's done great reporting on, who basically both told the same story. One was in CPD and one was on the mayor's team, saying no one's serious about implementing this consent decree. We're getting stonewalled at every corner. We can't make progress. That's the stuff that improves the culture, the morale, the leadership, and the competency of the Chicago Police Department, not political sideshows like John Catanzaro.
Bring in the heat.
Ooh, man. And by the Portillo's. Way, that in light of the deterioration of the Portillo's chopped salad. So it's not even...
And a deterioration of their, I feel like since it went public, they're like that has actually gone down a little bit. Cause I remember, I don't know about you guys going to Portillo's and being like, wow, this is like Navy SEALs level,
yes.
You know, yes. Synchronicity in here. Like they're great. They're still pretty good. Not quite at that level. Still better than the Chicago Police Department.
So even a C+ Portillo's is better than the CPD.
The system's completely broken. And, you know, for all the flack Rahm Emanuel gets for his flaws when it comes to police reform, Lightfoot's administration has done nothing. The consent decree point especially. This has been kicked down the can for so long. And she partially ran on police reform and getting to the consent decree and meeting those deadlines, and none of that's happened. You've brought in a new CPD superintendent who spouted lines about police reform. It hasn't happened. He's nowhere to be found. You don't see him on TV. He doesn't do what Eddie Johnson used to do, where he had the monthly crime stats and went to different TV stations and radio stations. He's not visible. So we're at a point now where, yeah, you're going to get these Catanzaras popping up, you know, who are that fringe element, but it's way more than just the fringe element that's at fault here. It's the left. It's the Democrats, the people in power. Nothing is being done. That's literally the issue. So yeah, Austin hit the nail on the head there. I'm flattered that Catanzaro is using, you know, me as a rallying cry. Let's go Brandon. Okay, great. I don't know if that's, I can't say that I can accept that endorsement, but
I think that's his campaign theme for mayor. And by the way, he doesn't want to be mayor. He just loves attention.
All.
That's all. He's going to run
he's
for
not
mayor.
Win either. Oh. He knows he's not going to win.
If I could just throw a little bit of statistical information at Mr. Catanzaro, that this city voted 82.5% for Joe Biden and 10.2% for Donald Trump in 2020. So the odds of him, who's a committed Trumper, being elected mayor are zero. But I'm wondering whether this is good news for Mayor Lightfoot, because he's a great enemy, great foil to have, and he's going to draw vote. I mean, he may get 10-15% of the vote, but it's going to come at the expense of some perhaps more credible candidate who's going to try to run to her right, not all the way to her right, maybe a Paul Vallis, someone like that, who didn't do very well the last time around either. But to have an enemy like Catanzaro is probably a good thing for Mayor Lightfoot. I know, I saw there was some poll out this week. I don't know how reputable it was. It showed that her approval ratings are down, and people are looking for another face in City Hall. So this might actually be a good week for the mayor.
Nobody's numbers are worse than the president's, though. His approval and disapproval numbers are, 41 and 53? Wow.
One poll.
Wow. Well, okay, do you think that poll is wrong, John?
No. Sorry. I've been saying that for every single poll that keeps coming out showing Joe Biden underwater. You put them together, it's a little bit better than that. I'm always shocked when I see it. I guess I just don't get it. But, you know, we're very polarized and people are paying more at the gas pump and people are paying more at the grocery store. And that always impacts polling numbers of whoever is in charge. But unemployment's under 5%, 2 years ahead of schedule. The stock markets are doing so well. Retirement accounts continue to grow. Inflation is a byproduct of pent up demand. I don't know. I guess I have not flipped to the other side, but I'm really surprised. And people have said it was going to last for a while, even after Afghanistan, that the numbers continue to sag this low for the president.
I wondered if there was going to be some honeymoon after the infrastructure bill got signed. It doesn't seem to be that at all. But it would seem to be like that's the sort of thing Democrats could take home. And maybe when they start breaking ground on some of these projects. But right now, they don't seem to be getting any sort of bounce.
They only signed it on Monday. And it's going to take some time for any of these projects to be real to people when they actually see a bridge being repaired or a road being paved. So, I mean, I think I'm in the John Hansen camp on this. It's like, let's take some deep breaths and let's wait, because people aren't going to vote for another 11 months, more than 11 months. And so let's wait and see what the lay of the land is. Then let's see where inflation is. Let's see where joblessness is. Let's see in particular where COVID is. I think COVID has hurt Biden. You know, he was heralding the end of COVID and we're returning to normal. And now the statistics are going the other way and we're heading into the winter where it's going to be tough. But by next summer, by next fall, things could look very different in this country. So it's never too early to panic in politics, but maybe it is on a podcast.
Yeah, infrastructure is just not sexy. I
mean, you got that right.
we our types get excited about it, right? John especially, John Hanson, he loves infrastructure.
Love it.
Week. He's loved this long infrastructure week, this months long infrastructure week, but. For the average voter, it's not going to get them jazzed up. And what they're thinking about now is that gas tank. They're thinking about inflation, and they're seeing interviews with Biden officials where on TV they're literally not answering the question of what can you do right now to fix this, to do something to impact this. And that's people's concern right now. So those numbers are going to continue to be low until people see an immediate impact with their wallet and in their homes.
Yeah, they're planning 1,000 infrastructure events, Democrats are, over the coming weeks and months, which I think is good. That sort of stuff on the local news makes a difference. I do love that we already have one Republican. It took 31 hours for a Republican congressman who voted no on infrastructure to take credit for something that's being fixed in his town in Alabama. I had it about 48 hours. Kind of surprised it came.
That was your over under 48?
So early. President Biden should deliver a major address and start doing something actionable on inflation. Because even though, and people are trying to compare this to the 70s, I just pulled up the numbers. You're talking about inflation over 8% over 8 years, sometimes in double digits in the 70s. We're nowhere near that. So that comparison is bunk. But something, show some action. He did release a statement today about gas prices, saying he wants the FTC to look at why are oil prices going down recently, which they have been trending over the last couple of weeks, but gas prices continue to go up. So maybe some moves like that will convince people that he's trying to do something, but it's not going to help until the numbers themselves, the prices go down.
Well, actually, sex is defined as infrastructure in the plan. So I think it won't be as hard as you think to make it sexy. But yeah, this inflation issue, I mean, I think it's the numbers 40% of U.S. dollars in existence have been printed in the last 12 months. The numbers are really mind-boggling. And this, I think, maybe John, you would know the number more than me. I think it's around 6%, people are saying, as the inflation number.
Yeah, 6.1 in October, yeah.
And the defense of that has been like, oh, it's transitory inflation. It's transitory in a sense that it may come down. But when that happens, that's like getting a pay cut at work. It's a permanent step decrease in your earnings trajectory over the course of your life. It affects people's earnings, not just today, the prices of things today, but their futures for years and years to come. It's a really, really serious issue. And I totally agree. The response to it has been basically blame everybody but the federal government. Blame supply chain issues. Blame OPEC. Not taking responsibility for it. I think that's the wrong tact.
One of the other things that is in that infrastructure bill we talked about today is by 2026, all new cars manufactured in the United States will have to have some sort of passive DUI detection system so that you can't operate the car if you're drunk. Can you believe that? 2026. It wouldn't be a device you blow into, but there is a sort of, it almost looks like a decal on your dashboard. It's a sensor, and it will tell if your exhalations have alcohol in them, and if it's at a high enough level, the car won't operate. And that technology exists, and I guess it works. I was talking to a transportation expert today, and he said it's actually pretty good technology. There's a million ways around that.
That's awesome.
I mean, I'm not for drunk driving, but I see it as so incomplete. There's so many ways to get around it. And I don't like the federal government telling car makers how to make cars to, you know, forestall every possible eventuality.
I like the federal government instituting safety standards. And I mean, I think that it was really good that they required seat belts and airbags and things like that. this technology, it does seem like something you could get around easily. It also seems like one more thing to go wrong in a car. Like if you're
another
if your breath
chip
detector doesn't work, then you got to take it in for service. I you hate to be opposed to something because it sounds like you're in favor of drunk driving, but gosh, that sounds like a bit much, doesn't it?
I think it's stupid. I'll just say it. I mean, like it's not going to work. Things are going to go wrong with it. And drunk driving, of course, is terrible, and it has killed a lot of people and continues to do so. But the numbers have gone down drastically in a generation. These are generational issues. And, you know, the work outside of what the federal government is doing has already really shred that number lower and lower each year. Let's just continue to go on that trajectory.
I want to talk about a book that has made news in the Chicago area this week and has across the country for the last several months. Gender Queer is a graphic novel that deals with issues facing young LGBTQ people. It's written by a Maya Kobabi, and it's Kobabi's story of coming out and dealing with all the issues adolescents deal with, but from the perspective of someone trying to determine their gender identity. One of the panels shows two nude males engaged in sex. You don't see genitals. And other images and words have made some adults uncomfortable. There is one copy of that book in the library at Downers Grove North. And at the last school board meeting, it was packed. And many of the people had no porn signs. The book has won awards, but has been the object of scrutiny and exclusion across the country. I talked to Hank Thiele, the superintendent at Downers Grove, this week. He says they're going to get some of these upset parents and some of the teachers in a room where the volume is turned down a little bit to see if they can't come to some sort of agreement about what to do with the copy.
I heard Thiele on your show. I've never heard someone pee down both legs. He was
wait
that
a minute.
Interview. He was like he didn't say anything. He just was, oh well, we're going to talk about it. And you kept asking him for his view of it, and he wouldn't give it to you. I John Hansen, you went to high school out there, right?
Yeah. So there's a copy at Downers North and a copy at Downers South, and the meeting was at Downers North, but it represented both high school districts, and that's what made me gay, to steal the joke from Eric Czar. No.
You saw my that book quotes, and you went, hey, I think I'll try that as a lifestyle.
I think I'll try that. Two drawings of men together naked. It's not like I could go on the computer and find a billion images like that if I so choose. One of my favorite quotes before I get too deep into this was from the student who said, I don't know a single person who's taken a book out of the library at all, ever.
We have a library?
Yes. And what really drives me crazy is you can have discussions and debates about what is appropriate for teenagers to have access to or not. But it's an outside group of agitators, essentially, at these meetings. This was the meeting was posted by a Proud Boys organization that went through a messaging app that rallied a bunch of people. They wanted all the folks from Downers Grove themselves to speak first, or from people that have kids at the schools. And all but three parents were totally in favor of having the book on the shelf. These are outside agitators who, by the way, had to be yelled at a couple times to wear their masks. And they objected to that. So these are freedom-loving people that don't want government overreach advocating for freedomless censorship using government overreach. It makes no sense to me.
You know, it's wild hearing the complaints that this is pornography. And then you think about classic literature you read when you were in high school. Ernest Hemingway, Toni Morrison, Dracula by Bram Stoker. Like, all these books have sex scenes or steamy scenes or things that allude to sex, and they're in high school libraries, and they've not been banned at all. Matter of fact, there's whole syllabi that are based around these books. So for this to now be an issue, oh no, sex, it's graphic, oh my, it's lunacy to me. You're not looking hard enough at the libraries that you guys have, because I know there's some other stuff in there.
To John's point, John Hansen's point about what kids actually have on their phones, right?
Yeah.
I mean, all these kids are carrying around phones with instant access to things that are 10 times more graphic. I went online to look at the images from this book, and yeah, they're not wholesome images, but they're certainly way tamer than anything you would find in a moment search online, that every kid in that school very few exceptions, I'm sure, is carrying around a smartphone that could access that.
Which is not, I don't think, an argument for having it in the library, though. I mean, just because kids see it or have access to it does not mean that you should also have it at your school library. At some point, you got to draw the line, right, Eric?
You do, but yes, you do. But this book is, as you pointed out, it's won awards. And it is something that as I've read the book, it helps kids who might be going through some of this, you know, gender dysphoria, some of these feelings that they don't know, quite know what to do with. And it looks like it's a very well done book that explores the kind of things that kids are thinking about. It's not pornography. It certainly is not pornography. It's not, like I say, it's not wholesome, but it's something that I think could help kids. It's one book in the library. It's not part of the curriculum. I'm not forcing kids to read it.
Nobody's teaching it.
You don't graduate from Downers Grove if you don't read this book. I think the book belongs in the school library.
But you could also flip that. And the same way you would say you can get pornography anywhere and it's going to be worse than this, so too can you get this book anywhere else besides the school library. In fact, they've only got one copy. I asked the superintendent, I said, you know, without even fighting this fight, just get rid of the book and do so in a way that does not pass judgment on its appropriateness or its pornographic content, but simply you can make this whole stupid thing go away if you just take the book off the shelf.
Whoa. Take the book off the shelf and make no judgment about what it is. That is the act of taking that off the bookshelf is what you did. You mean you could have done it quietly without anyone ever knowing about it, that it existed in the first place. Okay. 40% of transgender teens try to kill themselves. Not think about killing themselves. Try to kill themselves. This book can save lives by making it okay for people to feel like they are okay, that they are not abhorrent creatures. This is coming from someone who prayed a long time to not be gay and thinking that there was something wrong with me. And I had it easy. And knowing and seeing Will and Grace on TV made me feel a little bit better about everything.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Like this is not just, you know, like even the thought, if they actually ever pulled that book off the shelf, those parents would see me and about 10,000 of my friends in a moment at Downers Grove.
I like the image, though, of the superintendent being like, guys, the book's gone. And then it's like in the book, trash, what book? Over in the, like, what book? It wasn't even there in the first place.
Well, let me just may insert this point because, John, I was playing the devil's advocate there. I suggest that to the superintendent because I thought that's what some people are thinking. Just take the damn book down. And in his defense, he said that would be the kind of act of cowardice that would get 10,000 people there. If you're going to be a leader, you've got to make a decision on this. Go ahead, Austin.
This sort of culture war is not going to go away anytime soon. I think it's very much of the moment. And it makes me just think about, like, public schools are not good venues for democracy of this kind. And I think one thing this makes me think about is the fact that now, if there are outside agitators, that's one thing. But if people weren't constrained to their zip code for the school that they wanted to go to and could easily go to a school that better aligns with their values and take the money with them to go do that, I think you start avoiding a lot of these sorts of conflicts that are almost irreconcilable. There's going to constantly be people who say this shouldn't be in this school and others that say it should be. And because they're all paying money, their property tax money all goes to this, you have to listen to all of them. Now you have people with completely different ideologies wanting different books in this school. They're all forced into the same one. It's very contentious. I think these sorts of cultural problems are just going to escalate the longer that we have a system like that.
I don't even think this was a legitimate debate. I think those people were just using this school when you looked at how sophisticated the signs were and the panels blown up on big poster boards, that wasn't the stuff of a bunch of parents the night before the school board meeting saying, hey, what we're going to do. It looked way more organized and it felt way more outside than inside that school district.
Definitely. Definitely. I mean, totally. You look at some of the flyers they have all these other issues bundled in to this one as well. And there were also reports of the Proud Boys, being activated in a sense or coming out there. So there's definitely some outside forces that are agitating this for sure.
Yeah. How many people really in that school district? I know this is your point again, Austin, right? How many people in that school district really want that book off the shelves or have even read it.
And the fact that it's not the fact that it's not being taught is the weirdest point of this to me. Like, I remember when I was in high school and in the Western suburbs, there was a big controversy about showing like an R-rated movie or something in class that everybody had to watch. Listen, if you're a parent and you're concerned that your kid is has to watch something to do well in school and it totally is misaligned with their values, that's one thing. If you have a place that's supposed to be like a font of knowledge and a place where kids can explore and learn different things and it's self-directed, which is what great learning often is, and you're complaining about that, making a huge stink about that, not really the most important issue to the success of high schoolers in Downers Grove.
These culture wars are the only thing that the right really has to activate on. And so they're taking every opportunity they can to use that. So when you see something in Downers Grove like this happen, or in Alabama or wherever, it activates nationally that base of people. These latch onto it so aggressively, these culture wars. We've yet to see if that's actually going to translate necessarily to electoral wins.
Thanks for playing devil's advocate, by the way, John. I wasn't trying to jump on your you as saying that that's what you were advocating for.
Oh, you totally blew me up, and that's you are so good at it. It's going to be a shame that I'm thinking about editing that part out. Let's just finish it this way. So Eric says that that's the superintendent who was trying to, I guess, straddle the line. I'm not familiar with pissing down both legs as an expression. I don't know exactly what that means.
You can understand just the vivid nature of it, right?
Okay, yes, but he did say there's a process that they're going to bring those, God bless him, now you got to go to another meeting, you knuckle chuck. So there's going to be these people, and they're going to be in a room drinking coffee, and then there's going to be some other people on the other side of the conference table, and they're going to talk it out. And the plan is they're going to see if they can come to some sort of accommodation. Either the book stays or the book goes, but everybody will be happy because we've come to a better understanding. That's probably not going to happen. So then the book is going to be put on. He described it as a kind of trial where a committee will be formed. I don't know who's going to be on the committee, but they'll make some sort of recommendation to him, the superintendent, and the school board, and ultimately they'll decide. I would guess.
But he didn't even say what he thought. I couldn't get a sense of where he was.
He didn't want to circumvent the process. He wanted to let the thing play out. So that
they should just put porn in the library. More kids would go.
Actually, yeah, porn here, a big sign. And by golly, they would show up. You know, it's funny, John, because that reminds me of the conversation we had this week with the Oak Brook police chief. Because we were talking about how there were some smash and grabbers in the Ulta stores in Oak Brook. People just show up. It's amazing how brazen they are these days, right? You show up with a garbage bag on your buddies, and you just start putting stuff in the bag, and people go, oh, it's happening. Hey, we got one here. And then you clear the store out, you get in your van, you drive away. So they caught these people, and the bond was $175,000. And when we put the police chief on, he essentially said, here in DuPage County, he says, we've actually thought about putting up signs, attention Cook County thieves, you will go to jail and it'll be hard for you to get out, unlike Cook County. And he even said that one of the guys in the courtroom or wherever the proceeding was where they overheard this, he said, don't worry, the amount of merchandise we took will be out today. And they said, no, here in DuPage County, it's different. The thresholds are different. We play hardball here. And the kid was like, oh, I wish I knew that. Otherwise, I wouldn't have come to DuPage County and committed this crime. So I just think it's kind of interesting how we sort of have this academic argument like, is Kim Fox too easy on these guys? And this guy is like, I got proof for you that she is, because this kid's still in jail. He hasn't been able to post bond. And the word's out that if you commit that crime here, you're not going home tomorrow. Speaking of the city and the suburbs, should the Chicago Bears be sold to the city, or should the city of Chicago buy the Chicago Bears? And we don't have to spend a lot of time on this because nobody on earth thinks this is going to happen, which is why one of the aldermen brought it up. Right, Brandon?
It's got to be. I mean, it's literally going to die very quickly. It's a feasibility study that he's going to propose. He's the city council floor leader for Lightfoot, George Cardenas, just to see if it's practical to do this, and I think we all know it's not, and this is not going to go anywhere. But the idea of it, that as the city of Chicago could handle running an NFL franchise when they could barely handle running a city.
You think it would get more people to show up and vote, though, if they knew they were also voting for the Bears general manager as mayor?
That's a good point.
The Sun-Times had a wonderful rundown today of all the ways that this is a stupid, crazy idea. It was in the guise of a news story, so it was sort of presented like talking to one person, talking to another. But as you go down all the reasons why this just can't happen, it's against NFL rules. It would require billions of dollars of investment from the city that's almost broke as it is. Just absolutely no way it's going to happen. And I guess these politicians want to act like they're not going to let the Bears go quietly. But, I think what they really need to do is figure out if they can deal with the Bears and find another place for a better stadium in the city. That's the only way they're going to keep the Bears. And there's no indication also that the McCaskies want to sell the Bears. So it's all a stupid idea. But if they do want to keep the Bears, they're going to have to play ball, so to speak, with the McCaskies.
I think this is another prime example of why there are too many aldermen. And this is the type of citywide policy you get from the average alderman. I'm reminded of, I don't know if you guys remember, Ray Lopez a few years ago floated this idea of a tax on childbirth, and it just makes Chicago like a laughingstock. This one maybe won't be as much, but more so to the suburbs about how stupid Chicago is being. But it's kind of embarrassing when things like this pop up, in my opinion.
I mean, if you thought trading up to draft Mitch Trubisky was a bad idea, Chicago, who's got this whole parking meter debacle, imagine what kind of decision they would make in the draft.
Different aldermen could do different things. I can see which one, I'm not going to say who, would be the offensive line coach. There's like different people you could assign.
Are you referring to the heft of one of the line coaches or the brains of one of the aldermen?
My internet seems to be a little glitchy now, John. I don't know.
Is it a coincidence that this came on the heels of the story that the Green Bay Packers issued 300,000 more shares of $300 issuances of stock so that the fans up there could show their support and literally just give money to the Packers? You can't sell it. You can't redeem it. It's a gift to the Packers. And I wonder if one of the guys picked up the paper and went, oh, we should do that. Why don't we get a team? Well, we got a team and we'll give up some money. Austin had an idea for one other topic for us here.
This is very tangential to what we've been talking about, but I think it's an interesting national story, and it's something that's good to follow up on, given that we talked a lot about this during the Trump administration. And that was the Steele dossier and the two indictments that have since happened in relation to that dossier. And I would highly recommend people look at the Axios story on this. And it's essentially similar to the Rittenhouse case. It's a case study in media literacy and understanding what certain stories mean, what certain evidence means, and what narratives are at play. And I think while the Steele dossier was not the sole source of a probe into the Trump campaign, it was a very, very significant one, especially in the minds of the public. And it has since been revealed to be essentially a phony, trumped-up document, no pun intended, funded in part by an opposition campaign. And I think regardless of the party roles, whoever's at play, that's something that people need to know and people need to be accountable for. There are some media outlets that have done an awesome job. Washington Post prominently made some corrections on this. But there are many others who talked about this story ad nauseum for weeks and weeks, months and months, made insinuations about it, who haven't owned up to it. And I think that's a part of this reestablishing media trust in the country. And I encourage people to stay apprised of that story.
Well, as they explain it, then summarize the Steele dossier. How valid was it? Who financed it? That sort of thing. What's the story of it now?
Well, yeah, the most recent news event was Igor Danchenko. That dossier was lying to the FBI, and he essentially made up detail. And I'm oversimplifying this, but made up details to then put in that document. And it was also, funded by folks who were connected to the Clinton campaign. So when you're using that stuff to kick off a federal government probe into an opposing campaign, that's really serious stuff. And I think everyone will remember, like Michael Moore even had a TV show. This is where the P-tape theory came from, was this dossier. There's a whole TV series about trying to find this P-tape. It was a massive media event with very little done to kind of set expectations among the public of what the origins of this were. And we're seeing more and more in the wake of this Durham investigation what the origins were of it.
You talk about media literacy. I think if you said, I'll say Steele dossier, you say the first thing that comes to mind. A lot of people would say P-tape. And so are you telling me that there's no P-tape?
That was why I was bringing this up, just to set the record straight.
Well, but I mean, really, it's because it had an air of plausibility to it. Like, I could see Trump he's wackadoodle enough, and all of that is completely fabricated. Is that the current read on it, Austin?
Pretty much. And I think a really good counterexample here, and I don't like making it so simple as like these are the two biggest party figures, but the Hunter Biden emails, right? The immediate reaction to that among the same sort of folks was a skepticism about the source of these documents, which is totally fine. A skepticism that included, by the way, this is Russian disinformation. And this is sort of a similarly, those were real. Those have been authenticated, whereas this has been completely debunked. And yet the reaction was sort of totally different.
Yeah, it seems really obvious to me that media people, just like the public, rush into their silos to view this information as it comes out. And I get to circle back to the Rittenhouse trial, where I think this also happened, that immediately people just rushed off into whatever presuppositions they had about the people, kind of people who were involved. And as you said, John, this sounds a lot like Trump, right? I mean, it wasn't true, but it sounded like Trump. So people went with it, and they assigned it a whole lot of credibility. And the Hunter Biden story, they were like, well, we like Joe, and so we're gonna look at all these things through the prism of our own political biases. So I think this is a really good lesson. Maybe both these stories and others will provide us a lesson in attacking these stories as readers, as viewers, with skepticism and not with credibility. Not saying, well, what are the people I agree with? What are they shouting? What is Rachel Maddow shouting? I like Rachel Maddow. Rachel Maddow blew the Steele dossier story. She really blew it. She's getting, what, $8 million a year now? So, and I'm unemployed, but it doesn't matter.
I'm not laughing at your unemployment. I just think that's a funny little aside. Keep going, Eric.
I just want to also say that it looks like now the jury up at the Rittenhouse trial is looking at the drone video. Earlier, they weren't going to look for it. So now they're going to look at it. So very interesting stuff up there. By next week, we ought to have a verdict.
I want to know, though, like, because obviously news agencies should have been very more clear, if reporting it at all, of the unvetted nature of the document in which that was originally presented. You're always going to have fringe media operations that will print this stuff and will get consumed, and then they become stories themselves. So, Austin, is it a matter of teaching in grade school media literacy to be skeptical, to do that? Like, I don't know what the answer is, because a news organization could say, this is unvetted, this is unvetted, this is unvetted 20 times, and no one's going to listen to it if they don't want to.
I think it's exactly Eric's point, which is that you need to be aware that stories like this are often, whether the reporters themselves know it or not, meant to evoke as much of an emotional response in you as possible. And you need to be aware of that bias in your own head, that your brain is constantly on the lookout for things that confirm that bias. And if someone feeds it to you and says, this isn't vetted, that doesn't matter in your brain. Your brain is thinking, oh, this confirms my priors. It's definitely vetted. This is good to go. So I do think it's about looking inwardly as much as we can write all the media criticism and create all the substacks in the world that say, you know, that corporate media is bad. But it's really about being aware of yourself.
I wonder where this fits into that whole conversation. Drudge had the Monica Lewinsky story, but Newsweek had it first. They didn't want to report it. They were going to vet it, get triple checked on everything. It was too salacious to go with. And was it Isakov had the story, and Drudge broke it in front of him and everybody else, and it made the Drudge report it.
Oh, yeah.
Report. There's also a history of sometimes those kinds of stories being right in a media world that is so competitive to be first. That's an uphill climb, isn't it, what you're asking?
Right, which is why I think you probably can't put the onus on those institutions. You have to put it on yourself and the people around you.
Throw a book in the library. Teach kids about it. They'll go check it out if there's porn there.
John, you have been in rare form the last couple of weeks. Hey, as we wrap up this podcast, by the way, Eric, what was the email that somebody sent us.
Oh, somebody had said that they had heard like all 100 episodes of the Mincing Rascals.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
And I pointed out to you that, in fact, we've been doing this since 2015, and there are more than 300 episodes of the Mincing Rascals. The iTunes has apparently deleted the first 200 and some, but there are we are well over 300 episodes right now.
Yes, Bob Jackaway sent us a note, I think from Rockford, and he said it was a big day. He was looking at his phone, and his app said that he has listened to 99 episodes of The Mincing Rascals and is anxious for number 100. So thank you, Bob, for listening, and we hope this one doesn't disappoint. And we're also still hopeful that somebody invites us to, in a way that we can make money, do the Mincing Rascals podcast remotely or cover costs at least. Eric, you're in charge of that fact finding mission, right?
I'm on the case. I totally am. Yes, email me.
Well, considering Brandon just hitches rides from Zorn, it saves us a little money there. So.
That does.
And it's Eric Zorn at Gmail, and if you want, I'll sign you up for the Picayune Sentinel newsletter too.
Then tell Eric where we should go, and we'll try and get to your neighborhood soon. Okay, Brandon Pope, Austin Berg, John Hansen, Eric Zorn. Thanks for being part of the pod this week. I'm John Williams. We're produced by Ashley Byhun and Aleph Garris. We'll drop another podcast on you next week.
Okay, speaking of next week, are we going to try to do it on Tuesday instead of Wednesday? Because
how do you guys feel about that? Yeah, I've got to scram Wednesday after the show for Thanksgiving. And John, your thumbs up. Austin, do you think you could do Tuesday about the same time?
I could do 1 p.m. to 2 p.m. or 3 to 4.
Okay. We'll try and get you in. If not, you'll be out. Brandon, Tuesday works for you?
Tuesday's great, yeah.
Easy, you're okay on that?
Yeah, 1 to 2 is good. It's fine. Actually, yeah, any of those times are fine. Remember, I don't have a job, so I can take a break from being out at the expressway off-ramp and come and enjoy the
Can you pencil that in?